From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up in the hour ahead, we'll have a debate about what the views are on preschool education. We'll be joined by Bruce Fuller and David Kirk, both who have written books on the subject, and we'll take your calls and emails after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to the second hour of this morning's forum. Last year, California voters rejected Proposition 82, which would have enrolled about 70% of the state's four-year-olds in half-day preschool programs at no cost to parents. Still, there's a national movement, as well as one here in California, for universal preschool education, and UC Berkeley professor of public policy David Kirk believes the universal preschool movement is growing and socially desirable and necessary. UC Berkeley's Bruce Fuller, a professor of education and public policy, views the issue from a different perspective and writes about his research and views in Standardized Childhood, the Political and Cultural Struggle over Early Education. Professor Fuller has also taught at Harvard and was a research sociologist for the World Bank. Professor Kirk's book is called The Sandbox Investment, The Preschool Movement and Kids First Politics. Both are widely published, nationally known, and both join us for this hour. Let me say hello to David Kirk, who's here with us in studio.
Good pleasure morning. To be here.
Glad to have you, and also say good morning to Bruce Fuller, who joins us from NPR West in Los Angeles, ISDN line. Morning, Bruce.
Good morning, Michael.
Glad to have you both here. And I'm going to begin in studio with David Kirk. Really, what you're talking about in the book is long-term effects, morality, kids-first policy. And so from every vantage point, neuroscience, psychological, that you hit on socioeconomic equality, universal preschool is something whose time has come.
I don't think there's much argument that early education is important for all kids. It's clearly the case that kids from troubled backgrounds are going to benefit most. But it's also the case that just the socialization that goes on in preschool and the kind of creative thinking that good, inspired teachers can encourage, it's a very important experience for 3- and 4-year-olds to have. And that's what's going on in the country. That's what people are recognizing now.
Cheaper than prisons, as you say.
A lot cheaper than prisons. And it's the reason why you get police chiefs and district attorneys, unlikely allies, organizing in a group called Fight Crime, Invest in Kids, to expend a whole lot of energy promoting preschool.
There are many who question the empirical data behind, all the successful kinds of things that are attached to those who go to preschool as opposed to those who don't. Let's go back to sort of the genesis of your book. There was a study in Ypsilanti, Michigan, that I believe was really sort of the cornerstone of a lot of your work.
It was the inspiration for my work. The Perry Preschool Study is the iconic study in the field, and in part because it was so well designed, and in part because it's a 40-year-long study, and it traces the effects of a preschool experience well into kids' middle life. And it shows that by any measure you'd care about, whether it's being on welfare income or being married or staying out of prison, preschool has significant effects. And in that case, the calculus was a rate of return of 11% a year, which is a lot better than the stock market is doing these days. Now, I think it's important not to rest on Perry. It's a long time ago, a different universe. Those are all poor black kids who are involved in that project. But what's impressive to me is how much data there is that says high-quality preschools make a difference. Head Start's another story. But if you have well-trained teachers and small classes and a serious curriculum and parent involvement, you will make a difference.
High quality being the key here, and can we get high quality, especially considering the cost of getting high quality, but also just talking to the superintendent, ironically, last hour and hearing about the travails in the public schools. They've been plaguing public schools throughout the nation. Can we bring the preschools to the kind of quality that you're talking about ideally here?
Well, I was listening to that show, and I thought it fascinating that he said, if kids aren't reading by third grade, they're in trouble. Well, one of the things that preschools can do, is get kids excited about reading. And I don't mean recognizing letters, because if kids don't recognize letters when they're 4, they're going to recognize letters when they're 5. But getting them prepared to read and excited about books is one of the things that a good preschool does. So I think there's a real connection between what the superintendent is talking about, and it's one of the reasons why San Francisco has promoted a universal preschool system.
I was astonished to read in your book that the language gap exists of about 52 million words in terms of the lower socioeconomic or poor families compared to those of economic better circumstances.
Yeah, I thought it was even, in a sense, just as amazing that a four-year-old from a professional family has a bigger vocabulary than the parent of a three-year-old where the parent is on welfare.
Talking to David Kirp, and again, his book, which is out and available, is called The Sandbox Investment. We're also talking this hour to Bruce Fuller, whose book is called Standardized Childhood. And Bruce Fuller, the concern that I really derived from your book about universal preschool education was mainly government interference, the idea that there's a kind of standardized childhood that might result.
That's right, Michael. Really two things. One is what happens when central government takes over an institution like preschool. David and others talk about preschool as something that we don't have in this country. We're sort of starting from scratch, but it's not true. The child care and preschool world is about a $47 billion industry in this country. About 80% of four-year-olds from affluent families already go to preschool. So the question is how do we equalize access and improve quality for the very kids that David's referring to, that is low-income kids from low-income families? So part of my concern is what happens when we incorporate hundreds of thousands of neighborhood-based preschools into a state-run system, one-size-fits-all system, and does that standardize how we think about the upbringing of young children at the very time that California society and around the country, our world is becoming much more diverse and pluralistic?
Your concern, though, and your apprehension seems to be that universal preschool might indeed take parents away from raising their children, or that we shouldn't trust this bureaucratic central government in a pluralistic society to try to find the formula that will mean quality preschool education?
I'm not taking the position that conservatives are taking, which is the family can bear this responsibility. We need public action. The problem is that we have a vast mixed market of preschools now. About two-thirds of all four-year-olds in California attend a preschool in a neighborhood-based organization, a YWCA, a church, a Head Start center. And just as K-12 is moving towards different models with charter schools and magnet schools and small high schools, moving away from a one-best system, ironically, the born-again preschool movement is moving towards a more standardized organization. And I think it characterizes a debate, or it's an example of a debate among progressives and moderates, as to how do we equalize educational opportunity by drawing on neighborhood-based resources rather than moving back to a welfare state, a highly regulated state, which tries to homogenize the upbringing of children.
How much of this, what you see as homogenization, has to do with pushing for higher test scores?
A lot. In part, I call my book Standardized Childhood because the new preschool advocates, and this is a fairly elite movement, Michael. It's led by a couple national foundations and some leading thinkers whose hearts are in the right place, but they've tried to ally themselves with K-12 interests, with the labor unions, and they want to put preschools, they want to move them from neighborhood organizations into the public schools. Senator Clinton's bill introduced last month would infuse the system with $10 billion new dollars, which is admirable, but her bill says that three-quarters of that money has to go to the public schools, when in fact two-thirds of the kids are not in public school-based programs, they're in neighborhood-based programs. So again, it's a debate around how do we build from the existing infrastructure, how do we tap into that energy at the grassroots, as opposed to a conventional liberal remedy, which is the centralized state knows best and it'll stamp out identical-looking preschools.
Should we look across the Atlantic? They seem to be doing a pretty good job in Europe, where many people are concerned.
Well, in the movement, there's great affection for France, which has a very homogenous conception of early childhood, and we're seeing some pushback there in immigrant communities and communities of color, in Paris especially. I think Scandinavia is more promising because it's more of a decentralized, mixed-market approach where neighborhood activists, local teachers, parents can come together and create their own programs. The central state in Scandinavia provides much more ample funding than we see in the U.S. It provides quality regulation, but it lets local people shape the content and the learning objectives and the day-to-day activities inside preschool classrooms.
Bruce Fuller, again, is professor of education and public policy at UC Berkeley, author of the recently published Standardized Childhood, The Political and Cultural Struggle Over Early Education. And David L. Kerp is professor of public policy at UC Berkeley, author of, by the way, 14 books. His most recent is The Sandbox Investment, The Preschool Movement and Kids First Politics, also written books like Shakespeare, Einstein, and The Bottom Line. And what about this idea we're hearing from your colleague, David Kerp, that this is, you seem to make the case that this is a political groundswell. I mean, Illinois, for example, is on track now to be the first state to offer universal health care. Too many programs I've done. Universal preschool education to three-year-olds. But this is being seen as, by Professor Fuller and others, as an elite movement trying to standardize things.
You know, I think there's really less disagreement between Bruce and myself. There's, you know, Bruce's, the rhetoric may sound different, but we both are concerned about quality. We both are concerned about the education of kids. And there isn't a preschool system in the country that I know of that isn't a system that taps those very resources that he's talking about, including the California initiative that went down. Illinois is a great example. Illinois features public-private partnerships. And the role of the public in that case is to set standards, and standards are awfully important. Every piece of data that we have says that most preschools are not doing much by way of educating. They're babysitting, they're monitoring, they're taking off kids' boots, they're feeding them lunch, they're cleaning up the lunch. And I'll tell you, when I went out and looked at those preschools, some of them were so bad that I wanted to run a rescue mission and grab those kids under my arm and run out of the school. And I sure don't know any parents, middle-class parents, poor parents, wealthy parents, who say, gee, it's totally easy to get high-quality preschool at a reasonable price for my kid.
How much of a problem is pay for teachers?
It's a huge problem. Insofar, preschool teachers, the best preschool teachers, are working small miracles every day. I mean, to watch the kind of learning that goes on, the light bulbs that are turned on at those incredible, if you please, teachable moments, is just a spectacular experience. They have a much harder job than Bruce and I do teaching university. We've got kids who want to be there. They're not throwing up. You know, they don't have to run to the bathroom every 30 seconds. We get paid a whole lot more than they do. And until the system realizes that the most important teaching is going on with 3- and 4-year-olds, more important than grade school teaching, and that's more important than high school teaching, as the superintendent was suggesting, till we start honoring those folks and recognizing their worth in terms of dollars, then we're going to continue to have trouble. And the best argument for involving the public schools in this story is that the teachers then get paid the same salaries as public school teachers do, not the half or two-thirds salaries that Head Start teachers get now.
What about Senator Clinton's bill that Bruce Fuller alluded to?
I think it's an interesting effort at trying to infuse money into the system. I think it will need a lot of fine-tuning along the way. Senator Clinton has been a proponent of preschool for many years. She's also pushed for what I'm calling kids first politics, promoting the general interest of kids, because, as we know, preschool is not a be-all and end-all. It's just part of a larger set of concerns about how it is that we make America a better community to grow up in. And that's been Senator Clinton's concern since her days in Yale Law School.
Bruce Fuller, if we invest in preschools and try to move toward universal preschools, is there empirical data that suggests that we would indeed do a good deal to ameliorate or close the achievement gap?
Well, I think that is the essential question, Michael, and Brother Kerp and I disagree a little bit on this. He cites in his book the valid studies that show big gains for kids from poor families. On the other hand, there have been 3 national studies now looking at the effects on kids from middle-class families, and those benefits are small at the beginning, and they basically fade out by the second or third grade. So in my book, I really look at the history and mount the argument that we need to stay on course with focusing resources on low-income and blue-collar communities. There are vast numbers of families who don't qualify for subsidies yet can't shell out $8,000, $9,000, $10,000 a year, and we do have to liberalize eligibility for public support. But if we jump to an entitlement, as Senator Clinton's proposing, the worry is that we move away from seeing this as a way to narrow gaps, and we simply reinforce inequalities. I mean, the analogy is with class size reduction in California, where we spend $2 billion a year to reduce class sizes from kindergarten through third grade. It's very popular all parents and kids benefit from it. There's no evidence that it's helped to close early learning gaps because it's a universal entitlement.
Speaking about evidence, a couple of questions on that score. Wasn't there a flap a little while back with Mike Hurst of Stanford concerned about some of the things that you pointed out about the No Child Left Behind program? Can you elucidate that for us?
Well, that has more to do with whether the current array of reform efforts is really raising achievement in the early grades. And what we're seeing is that since the passage of No Child Left Behind, achievement levels have been leveling off, that the success we saw in the 1990s in closing achievement gaps has narrowed. Now, I do agree with David and with Senator Clinton that No Child Left Behind needs to be turned upside down. We need to put more resources in the earliest grades and in preschool and address this inequality in how we spread our resources across the grade levels. But it also suggests we need to address preschool and the early grades in K-12. We can't see preschool as a single silver bullet, especially for middle-class and blue-collar kids, where now two or three national studies have shown that preschool effects really fade out by the second or third grade.
And what do we know about school-based programs' efficacy as opposed to community-based programs?
There have been only about three or four studies. George is very interesting because Georgia was the first state to create a universal program, but they ramped up from the poorest communities up through blue-collar and then middle-class communities. They did not put it in the Department of Education. They created a separate agency to protect community-based programs. And there's a study out by Gary Henry, who's an economist in Georgia, that shows the community-based programs are actually slightly more effective than the school-based. And that seems to be because the community-based programs operate a bit like charter schools. They don't have all the personnel hassles and hurdles for young, bright teachers to get into the system. So those neighborhood organizations in Georgia, at least, have been able to attract very strong young teachers and outperform the school-based programs. Other studies have shown, Michael, no difference between the two sectors.
Again, Bruce Fuller's book is Standardized Childhood, and David Kerbs is a Sandbox Investment. David, I think both of you have given strong evidence that your hearts are in the right place, and I don't mean right in any political sense. I mean correct as you see it, and that you're very collegial toward one another. But your research does contradict what we're hearing from Bruce.
Some of it does. Let me tell you a story that motivated some of my concerns. I was in a school in Chicago in a poor neighborhood. And on one side of the hall, there was a half-day program, free, for kids who were called at risk. And that's one of these, you know, kitchen sink categories that I don't make much of. Kids whose home language wasn't English, kids who were developmentally delayed, whole variety of background issues. It was a great program. A wonderful teacher, one of those miracle worker teachers, free. Across the hall, there was a full-day program, very similar in nature, except more nap time and more meals, but in a longer educational period, ran from 8 to 3. It was a tuition program. Parents paid $8,000 a year. And for them, it was a great bargain because that program in the market would cost them about $15,000 a year. The school district was running that program because it wanted to get middle-class parents to send their kids to the kindergarten and elementary schools in Chicago. Well, right down the hall, there's kindergarten. And I thought, just imagine if on one side of the kindergarten corridor there were half-day free programs for poor kids and kids who've got learning problems. And across the hall, there were full-day programs for those who could afford to pay for it. You'd have a civil rights lawyer in court in a second and a half complaining about that. And why we should treat four-year-olds differently from five-year-olds is a vexing mystery to me. Indeed, we seem to have it just backwards. Economists say target on those who need it most, which is the argument Bruce is making. Well, why not target at first grade? Why not target at sixth grade? You know, at what point do you say, no, we've made a compact with the people to have common education, a common school possibility, the possibility that kids across race and class lines can come together. Not a guarantee, but if you have the kind of schools that my colleague Bruce is talking about, if you have a Montessori school here or you have a Reggio Emilia school, you find that parents will drive their kids to a different neighborhood to send them there. So there's at least the possibility with universal preschool of having some degree of mixing. If you have a targeted program, what you've got is an economically and racially segregated program. Now, I think Bruce and I would agree on the following proposition, that you need to start where the need is greatest. There isn't enough money in the till to do the whole thing at once.
And indeed, to do, the whole thing at once, estimates of like $50 billion.
That's right. And, you know, we won't compare that with the money spent on the Iraq war, you know, in a given hour. But, yeah, $50 billion is not chump change. And, indeed, those states like Florida that have gone immediately to universal preschool have been disasters. So building up from the communities that need it most, not poor parents, the problems that that creates, but communities where the education track record is weak, and gradually expanding the system so that it's a targeted universal system. All the kids in a neighborhood where school performance is low get preschool, and then the program expands to neighborhoods where performance is higher. That seems to me a sensible ramping up strategy, to go from the greatest need to the overall system. But I think the goal needs to be a preschool education, a pre-kindergarten education for all, a quality pre-kindergarten education with lots of choice built in for parents. And again, for all that language about welfare state and standardization and the like, at least in every state that I know of, that isn't what's happening. It's really a straw man argument.
What about that strategy that you're hearing here, Bruce Feller? I mean, move within the communities, ramp it up, put the attention or focus on those communities that need it most, and aim for not necessarily standardization, but something that would indeed embrace choice.
I do agree with David on that, Michael. My only worry is that as Hillary Clinton and others talk about universal preschool, it's a useful strategy for mobilizing middle-class support, but A, it's not clear that preschool is going to distinctly help kids from upper middle class backgrounds and affluent backgrounds. If they stay at home, they're in stimulating settings. So there's a worry about a false promise here. It's a little bit like farm subsidies. The corporate farmers say we need more subsidies to help the little guys, but in fact, the money ends up helping the big guys. And secondly, on the standardization point, Oklahoma does run its system through the public schools, and it's leading to the closure of a lot of community-based programs. Running it through the K-12 system obviously pleases the teacher unions, and any presidential candidate running as a Democrat is going to want that union support. But again, as the politics get hot and heavy, in expanding the system, will we really concentrate resources at the low end, or do we create a political economy which essentially helps the big guys and the families who can already afford to pay? So it's that disjunction between the rhetoric of universal and how we really do need to target, as David is suggesting.
Well, let me bring the public into this discussion. We indeed would like to hear from you, hear your thoughts about this whole question of reform of preschool. Talking to a couple of professors of public policy who have just put out books on the subject, David Kirp, professor of public policy at UC Berkeley. His book is The Sandbox Investment, and Bruce Fuller, who is professor of education in public policy at UC Berkeley, and his book is Standardized Childhood. You can join us now at our toll-free number, whether you're listening to us on radio, internet, or Sirius satellite. Feel free to do that. It's 866-733-6786. Again, toll-free from wherever or however you're listening to Forum, 866-733-6786. You can also send an email, and we welcome your emails with questions or comments. Our email address is forum@kqed.org. And when we return, your calls and emails. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're talking about reform of preschool with two UC Berkeley professors of public policy who have recently published books on the subject. David Kirp is the author of The Sandbox Investment, The Preschool Movement, and Kids First Politics. And Bruce Fuller, who is with us from NPR West, is professor of education and public policy at UC Berkeley and author of also recently published Standardized Childhood, The Political and Cultural Struggle Over Early Education. We're going to bring you, our callers, into this, and let's begin. Maria, with you. Good morning.
Yeah, hi. Good morning. My name is Maria from Parent Voices San Francisco. I am a mother of two kids who went to who started childcare when they were like 18 months and went to preschool. But all those programs were full-day programs. And as a working parent, I'm really concerned that a lot of talks around preschool is for part-time a day, which doesn't really work for working families. Every year we have to return money because of low enrollment. Preschool is underutilized. We also need to talk about infant and toddler, and I don't know where the two professors stand on that. And I'm really, really interested in discussions about making preschool full day and to serve families who cannot afford to pay it.
Let's take that first, Maria. I'm glad you brought it up because it's an important point. And David Kirk, what about underutilizing and full day?
You know, the caller is absolutely right about that. And one of the sadder moments in my travels was to visit the Chicago Child Parent Centers. Now, those are another one of those iconic programs with a great 20-year track record. But they were great programs when they were full-day programs. And the same story that Maria is telling in San Francisco is true there. There's a waiting list for folks to get into the full-day program, which the school district there is cutting back because it says it doesn't have the money. The half-day programs are going begging, and that the district is using as an excuse to cut back what really is a program that they should be totally proud of. It goes to the point that people can use the rhetoric, preschool for all, universal preschool, but they got to look under the hood and see what's actually going on. And the program really does, the combination of preschool and childcare really does have to relate to what it is that working parents need. Half-day programs where kids somehow need to get ferried from one place to another don't work for most parents.
What about infants and toddlers? She brings that up. And
well, I'm with her, and there have been efforts for many years to talk not about preschool and infants and toddlers, but to talk about early childhood education or to talk about 0 to 5 and the different kinds of education that kids need really from 45 minutes after they're born when they start tracking movements in the room. They are, as Allison Gopnik, our colleague at Berkeley, described them, scientists in the crib. And they, too, need rich stimulation. Now, historically,
you got a lot of that neuroscience research in your book, we should mention.
Yeah, I mean, yes. And you know, all of the neuroscience and even the genetics, which people have been scared of historically because of all the bell curve kind of biased studies, point in that same direction, that the first years really are the building block years for kids and you know, through that the rest of their lives. And all the data converge in that proposition. Increasingly, it's becoming politically acceptable to look to early education. So, you know, in a place like Oklahoma, which Bruce talked about before, you get the governor, the Democratic governor, running for re-election, and one of the primary main planks in his platform is a program for opening a program for two-year-olds, for toddlers, and you work your way back to infants. State of Nebraska voted a $10 million bond initiative to set up a program that's a 0 to 5 program. So I think that the point that little kids, you know, need an educational experience, not just babysitting, is one that's been known to the experts, and people have been shouting about it for umpteen years. And I think now the citizenry are willing to recognize that it's true, that, you know, the reality is that parents are working, and the reality is that kids of working parents are going to benefit from the best program that they can get.
Bruce Feller, let's get you to address this.
Well, the only other angle I would introduce, Michael, is, and I do agree with Maria in terms of the need for higher quality infant and toddler care. In my book, I do talk about Europe a little bit, because especially Scandinavia, even England, which is about as conservative as the U.S. on some social policy fronts, have legislated a balance between more quality care for young kids, but also more flexible workplace incentives, so that in England you can take up to a year off, not totally paid leave, but there's a legal guarantee with your employer. I think the worry is that unless we get employers involved in this dialogue, and unless we think about the balance between work and raising young kids, we're going to keep drifting towards a welfare state remedy, which is we just put little kids in institutions for many more and more hours each day, and in a sense we free up the labor of their mothers for corporations. And I think Europe has had a more critical stance on this, and they say, wait a minute, the economy should work for families, not the other way around. So let's have a balance of workplace policies as well as child care policies.
Yeah, I want to thank Maria for the call and say I was in Scandinavia recently, and they seem to do it right over there. Let me go to more calls, though. Susan, you're on. Good morning.
I just want to applaud David Kerp's recommendation that we begin in areas such as low-performing school neighborhoods. but make the program available to all families that happen to live in that neighborhood. It's really criminal. I've actually visited programs, sat with people who are in charge of enrolling children in preschool programs, Head Start programs, other types of community and school-based programs. Frequently, a parent will just be a dollar or two above the income eligibility for the program, and they have to just walk away. Their children cannot be in the program. And it's unfair. It creates a disincentive for parents to earn a little bit more money, and it's just totally unfair to children. So I hope this principle of equity will apply to whatever preschool policy we ultimately embrace.
Thank you, Susan, for your call. Bruce Fuller, want to opine on Susan's call?
Well, I think she's right in the sense, and David's right, that we want to see preschool as a way to bring a diverse set of kids together in the same community. On the other hand, the price tag, as you mentioned, Michael, is $45 to $50 billion a year. So there's got to be some needs-based testing, so to speak. We're going to look at parents' income and try to ration scarce dollars to those kids who benefit the most, that is kids from blue collar and poor families. So I think it's a dilemma how we ramp up. New Jersey does it right in the sense that they target on a community level, as David is suggesting, and then they allow all families to participate. New Jersey is interesting because you actually have some middle class families moving into poorer communities to enroll in free preschool, which may be a secondary and positive benefit of the program in terms of increasing integration across social classes.
David Kerr.
I'm delighted that on this point, as on others, we're in agreement. One of the nightmarish problems of focusing just on income is that you have a neighborhood, and right next door to each other, you know, Billy and Susie have been playing together, and then one day, because you know Billy's mom and dad make $1,000 more than Susie's mom and dad do, Billy doesn't get to go to preschool and Susie does. And to make it even worse, income fluctuates a lot. So somebody who's not eligible in August might very well be eligible in October and vice versa. We're a whole lot better off using preschool as a way of building communities and strengthening the sort of educational foundation of those communities.
Let me bring more of our callers in. And Jim, thanks for waiting. You're on with us. Good morning.
No problem. I'd like to say that my children, four of them, went to preschool at a cooperative in El Sobrani, and having been through that program, I saw the benefits of my children being able to interact with other kids and start their education early. And building on that, I would like to say that I think that that was pretty much the last generation of children that grew up with a family that could exist on one income. And I think that's a big key nowadays. Anybody that thinks that, oh, well, we've got all these middle class people out there that can send their kids to preschool and pick them up, you know, at noon, is, you know, they're not really seeing reality. The rich people can do that. But the other part of it then, another whying at the connection is that we need, I think, also to start the kids earlier nowadays because of the interference of, you know, electronic media into their lives, and we need to build on a socialization program. It's even more important now due to the fact that kids are isolated, you know, in small at home with babysitters or a couple of kids or whatever, and I think that it's very important for these kids to start to socialize at an age of, you know, where 2.5 or so, where they can build socialization skills to move on to primary school.
Well said, and I thank you for the call, Jim. Either of our reigning academics here want to comment on the comments we just heard?
Well, I'd only add that it's important that parents be brought into the story. because you don't get good preschool education unless you get parent involvement. And I don't just mean, you know, parents at home read to their kids. The best of the programs that I know of, the Chicago Child Parent Center program, actually had a parents' room in the school, and they would offer classes in whatever parents wanted, GED programs, English language programs, sewing classes, you know, job search classes, and those parents would spend part of their time working with kids. Now, for full-time employed parents, that's not going to work, but for parents who are working part-time or parents who are on welfare, it's a wonderful experience. I mean, parents are going to be the primary educators of these kids. On that point, Bruce and I very much agree. But there really ought to be a partnership founded on the demographic realities that parents are working, and kids really do flourish in an environment that's an educational environment.
Notwithstanding those demographic realities, Bruce Filler, I sense that some of your concern is over the fact that there will be parents who will pretty much depend upon a preschool as opposed to maybe depending more upon themselves with a greater parental role.
Well, I think that's true. I do think, though, parents are unified on one point, Michael, and that is that they care most about socialization and building the social skills and attitudes around empathy for other kids and cooperation, as Jim is suggesting in his call. And that's one reason the standardization worries me, because we have state politicians, we have a president pushing No Child Left Behind, who is saying that narrow cognitive skills around reading and mathematical concepts are the be-all and end-all of a liberal education, despite the fact that parents in national surveys say that for 3 and 4 year olds are much more concerned about socialization and teaching their kids how to get along with each other. So I think Jim's raising a very key point of that we've got to get down to what do parents really want from these programs, and it may not be what the No Child Left Behind hawks are pitching at the moment.
Our next caller joins us from Hattiesburg, Mississippi. Michael, you're on the air. Good morning.
Morning. Hey, I'd just like to say that I believe this is just a further socializing of America. I mean, where does it stop at? I mean, when the government going to get the kids health care and feed them also? It's just encouraging more people to have more kids that they can't afford.
David Kirk.
The government does give them health care, and the government does feed them. And the alternative is that they go without health care. A third of our kids are living in poverty right now. I'm not quite sure what the caller would do with them. Send them out in the streets to become mendicants? That's also part of the economic reality of the society. I do want to say, by the way, that on the No Child Left Behind story, I count myself as a dove, not a hawk. And one of the dangers in this area is that preschool becomes a way of pushing down narrow cognitive skills to 3 and 4 year olds. Here, again, the best teachers are those that unleash kids' creativity and the kind of schools that really allow kids to work and play well with others, as they used to say on report cards. And there's data on this, too, that says if you look at kids at age 3 and you sort of judge their capacity to do that, and then you have a look at them at age 18, a whole bunch of scales. What happened at age 3 affects the likelihood of teen pregnancy, smoking, juvenile criminal behavior, all sorts of things that the society cares about. So it's not just mush, and it's not just, you know, catering to parents. It's something that's really, really important for kids' development.
Let me thank the caller and go to some of your emails. Robert writes, I was particularly pleased when David Kirp related the costs of early child education with those being spent on the Iraq debacle. Every single federal social and infrastructure program that is underfunded could benefit immensely from the dollars we're throwing down the drain in Bush's folly, and amounts to about $200 million a day. Here's Sally, who says, how many preschoolers are dropped off at a home that only offers daycare because the parents can't afford preschool? How many of these kids would finally have a preschool experience if a public school could afford it? Any estimates on that from either of you?
Well, Bruce and I will have interesting data battles, but I think I want to leave those for the policy wonk conversation, not for KQED airing. But I will say that all the evidence suggests that most of child care programs are mediocre at best, and 1 in 8 are actually dangerous for kids, harmful to kids. And so, you know, it's no surprise that if you put a kid in a bad program, bad results are going to happen. This is one of those worlds in which you get what you pay for. And I'm worried. Quality is a big, big concern for me, because my nightmare fear is that politicians will talk about universal preschool. They'll implement something on the cheap. Nothing good will come of it. And folks like the caller from Hattiesburg will say, see, we told you so. Those kids just can't do anything. Why should the state be meddling in their lives? When, in fact, it's the lack of public dollars to provide the kind of quality education these kids need that's producing the lousy results.
That seems to me to be the fundamental equation here. Can you get the kind of quality with public dollars through the venue of using politicians to essentially create the programs that are necessary through legislation? And
well, I think the more politicians visit Florida, as the governor of Kansas did, the more they'll see how you don't do it. But it really does take parents being organized and community groups being organized and teachers pressing the legislators, not just for the label universal preschool or the label quality preschool, but for the reality of what that means in terms of paying teachers, expecting them to be qualified, having the right kind of class sizes, having a real curriculum that actually is going to engage kids' minds, not just a sort of unstructured, you know, free-for-all that goes on, getting parents involved. That's a package that parents groups and teachers and community groups ought to be able to unite behind.
Let's bring some more of our callers on here, and Peggy joins us. Morning, Peggy.
Good morning. I'm a professor of early childhood education at College of Marin, and I wanted to respond especially to a comment that was made a little bit earlier. I think Bruce was talking about the fade-out effect of preschool, and he talked a little bit about that in relation, or I think he did, in relation to No Child Left Behind. And what I wonder is, I'd like to look more deeply at those fade-out effects. Rather than being an indictment of preschool or saying that preschools are ineffective, perhaps it's more of an indictment of the methodology that happens in the early elementary years that focus on the narrow cognitive skills and what begins to happen to the young children when they hit those schools.
Yeah, Bruce Filler, you want to clarify here for us?
Well, a couple of points. I do agree with Peggy on the point that if we can improve the quality of kindergarten in the early elementary grades, we may be able to sustain the effect of preschool for middle-class kids. I mean, I don't think we should give up on the possibility that preschool could give a sustainable boost to middle-class kids. My worry is that the movement leaders are arguing that preschool helps all kids, full stop, when in fact the evidence shows that it gives a sustainable boost to kids from low-income and blue-collar families. And again, the national studies that have been done, most recently by the National Institutes of Health, have shown that preschool the effect fades out by the third grade. Now again, if we could radically improve quality, maybe that boost would persist into middle school and high school. But we've also heard this promise by entitlement advocates before, like class size reduction, promising that class size reduction would narrow achievement gaps, and almost 8 or 9 years later, we see no progress on that front. So I wouldn't use the word indictment, Peggy, but I would say we've got to be tough-headed about this before we abandon a half-century-old policy of targeting dollars on the neediest communities.
It might be an interesting research direction for the future to look at why those effects are undone.
I agree.
And thank you, Peggy. On we go to more of your calls. Dan is our next caller. Hi, Dan.
Hi. Thank you for taking my phone call.
Sure.
I think one basic problem has been the destruction of the neighborhood schools, that the fact is that people like to send their their children to schools with children of similar backgrounds. And the policy that has emphasized diversity rather than over academic skills and knowledge has been very destructive. Millions of people have left our large cities. They simply don't want their children being bused to other neighborhoods. As a result, the public school systems in many areas has been left to the poor people or to people who simply can't get out of the cities. And I think to reverse the policy, we're going to have to set a priority of returning to neighborhood schools. And I know my father, for example, came from an impoverished immigrant background. He went to an overcrowded public school that certainly wasn't ethnically diverse, but he received an excellent education. Today it's different, and I think your panel should also consider the cultural differences between people. Why do Chinese and Vietnamese of impoverished backgrounds come to this country? And their children do so well in schools. So I think these are important factors that should be taken into consideration.
Let me go to your first point, Dan, because the movement away from neighborhood schools may indeed, certainly as we know here in San Francisco, have a good deal to do with the notion of diversity or trying to ensure that diversity takes place. And David Kirp, how can we ensure that that kind of what some would call social engineering, I guess, particularly libertarians, would not take place in a universal preschool movement?
Well, I want to say just a word about the so-called demise of neighborhood schools. I mean, almost most children across the country go to neighborhood schools. And Bruce mentioned before and has done really good work on the phenomenon of charter schools, which suggests that many parents left to their own devices are going to pick a different kind of education based not on where they happen to live, but on the kind of experience they want their children to have. I don't see any evidence. Even Oklahoma has non-public schools in the mix, and you notice that Bruce stopped with Oklahoma, as you know, we have 39 other states to work our way through.
Yeah, we've got a governor there who's particularly sympathetic to this movement, though.
You do, and you know, there there was Bruce talked about parents moving to poor neighborhoods. Well, in Oklahoma, the program became universal because parents in middle-class communities said to the superintendent, "We want this program." And then started moving. And for the superintendent, seeing the dollars leave with the parents, there are all sorts of incentives to behave like this. But I just don't see any indication out there that what we're going to have is a one-size-fits-all, one-best system, standardized, Sovietized, communalized, welfare-statized system. That just in 2007, that just isn't on.
Well, one of the arguments you make in your book for universal preschool is kind of keeping up competitively with China, which is doing a pretty good job of having preschool for all of its children. And you talk about citizenship and global economy and those kinds of factors being tied in with the competition that we have with China. But what about the argument that China is a sort of standardized system? Is it, in fact?
Well, you know, one of my concerns in the book is that we actually spend too much time thinking about kids as little engines of productivity. It's the argument that sells these days, which is why we hear it all the time. It's a sound investment. There's return on the dollar.
It's often what brings legislation forward.
It is. Yeah. No, it's exactly what the politicians are listening to these days, which is why the economists are front and center in the conversation. But, you know, in passing, you mentioned
gets into the titles of books.
The value. Absolutely. Absolutely. It's indeed the way people think about this as an investment, but it's at least as important to think about kids as having richer, fuller lives and being better citizens and more engaged citizens in the society. Because, I mean, I'm very worried to see all the indices of disengagement in America, the rising levels of distrust of politicians, the paltry levels of people voting. And I think a lot of that has to do with the sense that people have that they don't know enough, don't care enough, are detached from the system or powerless from the system. And education has always been thought to be an important lever to change that. And to begin that story early, as a number of the callers have said, and I think Bruce and I agree, is a very important thing to do.
But where I see some real disagreement is Bruce's notion that this could lead to standardization. It could be. In fact, do you see China as an example of that, Bruce Fuller? Standardized preschool education?
I don't know China real well, Michael. I know France a little bit better, and yes, it is a concern. David can always outdo me on telling stories because he's a better writer than I, but my story from Tulsa is when I was doing my field work there, I was at a school-based preschool, and I did a focus group with four parents, and a young Latina mom just broke down in tears because not one staff member at that preschool spoke Spanish nor understood Spanish. So as we raise credential requirements, as we centrally regulate who gets to be a preschool teacher, you can imagine the kinds of interests that come into play to filter out and freeze out a lot of men and women who would be fine preschool teachers who come from the local community but can't meet these official state-crafted entry requirements. So I think the standardization is very worrisome as the society becomes more diverse. And that's part of the concern. On the other hand, Michael, I do agree with David that preschools can be magnets to hold on to the middle class in places like San Francisco and down here in parts of L.A. So I don't think we should eliminate or somehow constrain support for middle class preschools. But I think we've got to start from the bottom and work our way up towards the middle class.
Stories are important, but there's also some data on this point. In California, three-quarters of Hispanic parents say the best place for their four-year-olds is in a high-quality preschool. There may be a parent breaking down in tears, but I will tell you that one of the things that the preschool programs have tried to do is actively to recruit and train folks in communities to work in those preschools. So, again, if you listen to the voices of parents generally, you find pretty resounding support for preschool education for their kids.
Margaret, let's get you in here while we have just a little bit of time, please. Margaret?
Oh, I'm sorry.
Yeah.
I wanted to just make a comment about good citizenship and promoting democracy. When we worry about trying to get a democracy going in Iraq, I think that's an example of how democracy won't work when people are forever fighting with each other, can't get along with each other. And I can say as a child, I went to a Montessori school, and I got excellent preparation for being a good citizen. Later on, when we moved to New York, I had to deal with that melting pot atmosphere with people from all over, and I was able to fit in without any pain.
Well, that kind of education is, I think, what both our guests would like. That is, it prepares you to be a better citizen and to fit in with a little pain, and also to be more achieving and more successful and all the kinds of things that parents want for their children. This is an important conversation. I'm glad we had it, and I want to thank both of my guests. David Kerp, his book is The Sandbox Investment, The Preschool Movement and Kids First Politics, and Bruce Fuller, whose book is called Standardized Childhood, The Political and Cultural Struggle Over Early Education. Both are professors at UC Berkeley, and I thank them both for being with us. Thank you as well, our listeners. We would not be here without you, and we do appreciate and are grateful for your listenership. We're here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11, and an hour is repeated, 10 to 11 in the evening. I want to thank our producers, Robin Giannatasio-Mal and Kevin Guillory. Our senior editor is Dan Zoll. We have production assistance this week from Sarah Skickney and Tina Lauerberg. Engineer is Danny Bringer, and executive producer is Raul Ramirez. Thank you for listening. For all of us at KQED, I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Claude and Louise Rosenberg Jr. Family Foundation.